Welcome back, everyone. It is May 8th. This is the Let Me Be Frank podcast. Brian and Pete here, and we are joined by a very special guest. His name is Jack M. Silverstein. He's a sports historian, currently writing a book on the 90s Bulls called Six Rings, which is set to be released in 2021. You can find him on Twitter at ReadJack, and his website is shot on Elo at readjack.substack.com. He has a great interview, which everyone should read, with Robert Esquinas, the gambler who blew the whistle on Michael Jordan's gambling issues or competitive issues, whichever of the two you prefer. But Jack, thank you for joining us. We're super excited to have you.
Thanks, guys. Brian, Pete, appreciate you inviting me on. And just a note, not trying to be the dude, Richard Esquinas.
Yes. That's quick typo.
That's okay. I learned, I think it was How to Win Friends and Influence People. You know, they're like little things that you remember from different books if you don't remember everything. And the one thing I took from that, which I read when I was super young, was, I don't remember the exact wording of it, but it's something like, a person's name is the greatest sound in the world to them. And it was just this reminder that you always hit names right. So I just wanted to let you know.
I appreciate that. Quick typo, and yeah, we're off to a hot start.
I've been there, but hey, it gave me a chance to quote a book.
And so speaking of names, one of the, I was reading one of your commentary blogs on your site, and it was the one mentioning role players and favorite role players from the 90s Bulls teams.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that Cliff Livingston was your favorite role player from those teams. And when you mentioned that, I thought it was incredible, because growing up, my dad named our travel basketball team Good News.
Oh, warmed my heart.
I know. And it was funny because it was a bunch of kids playing who weren't old enough to know who Cliff Livingston was. So everyone who played against us thought we were just like the local church team spreading the good news.
How old were you guys at the time?
Oh, I think fifth or sixth grade. And I must have been – so we were born in 93, 94. So I remember maybe 1 year of the 90s Bulls. But my dad, just obsessed with Cliff Livingston. Mm-hmm. Always did the game time who before every game. So yeah. It was great to see that in one of your blogs. That's but awesome. Just to start off, like, easy, mentioning the a bit of the that we missed the 90s Bulls kind mm-hmm. of – how was in general just the fact that the Bulls were just absolutely dominant? Like, how was Chicago?
Yeah, it was like the most incredible thing in the world. And I think that when I'm writing, you know, I'm focused on one topic or another, and whether it's doing my newsletter or doing longer pieces like what I did for NBC Sports Chicago, where I wrote about Jordan's comeback from baseball, or a couple of years ago, I did one for Chicago Magazine, where I compiled a real-time oral history of the last day of the dynasty, where I went through and told the story of Game 6 through quotes from players and coaches that were from that night or like the next day. So immediately in the wake of it. And I think that these are, I love doing those and they're all great pieces, but sometimes they kind of, I guess they take as a given your understanding that this was just so fucking cool. Mm-hmm. And it's more, you know, the journalism piece, the history piece, the research piece. And we just don't get into the idea of like June 20th, 1993, driving back from my grandparents' house after Pax's shot and Horace's block. And people are just honking their horns all the way down 94, pitch just dead of night. You know, you don't get into the idea. I was talking to someone recently about, like, you know, everybody would do like the up and under, the Jordan reverse layup. You practice it at the schoolyard or mm-hmm. or maybe like the fadeaway, but we did stuff like the Bill Cartwright foul shot. And and it would be like one person would practice the free throw and would do the whole scoop move. Yep. And then the pause at the top. And when you hit the pause at the top, all of your friends would be standing in the lane and then would like do like a fake like lane violation. Mm-hmm. Or we did the, this was a personal favorite of mine, the John Paxson, how could you call that a charge excuse me, how could you call that a blocking foul when he was trying to draw a charge and he would fall back and like slide back and then do his own shrug? It was like all these little intimacies because you cared so much about this team that you were so embedded into it that you weren't just talking about what Jordan did. You were talking about what every single person, 1 to 12, did, and assistants and trainers. It was the clothes you wore. It was your birthday party. It was your, you know, you turned 16 or if you turned 18 or whatever your milestone was, somehow the Bulls were involved. You know, Ray Clay was getting hired to announce bar mitzvah kids like on the North Shore. And you know, there was Shoot the Bull over the summer, the 3-on-3 tournament. I've just been talking to guys and we've been writing about that. I've been talking to guys who were competing in Shoot the Bull. And the way that that popped off, you know, it started in 89, but then like anything that was Bulls related, by the, once we were winning titles, everything Bulls related took on this huge, massive urgency and excitement. And, you know, MJ had a quote after the 97 title where he said, you know, it was always like Chicago was like a wait till next year city other than the 85 Bears. And now we're, he was like, and now we're like an every year city.
Right.
And he said something like, I just want like, you know, he was, I don't think he named them in this, but he was referring to Jerry Reinsdorf. And he said, I just want like everybody to like, think about the joy of this night and how we have it, you know, we have it 5 out of 7 years. And that's what it was about. It was about that joy that the greatest show in sports was your local team. And you know, you talk to people, anybody who was growing up around then, say, oh, why, you know, who do you root for? Oh, well, you know, I was a Nuggets fan, but you know, I was a Bulls fan, you know, right. Like, or there are so many basketball fans overseas whose introduction to the NBA came with MJ and they became Bulls fans. You go overseas today, any overseas travel I've done, you see people in Bulls gear, and it's not because they're D Rose fans. Some of them are, you know, because Derek has a huge following in China. But it's my point with saying him is that he was an MVP of the league, and it's not even because of him. Mm-hmm. It's because of what that 90s team, oh, I like to say two 90s teams, but it's because of what they did and what they meant. And it was just everything. And it's like, you know, you're a sports fan and you always hope that one of your teams punches through. And even if one of your teams punches through, then you kind of, it's like you have them for the run-up, but that's a different kind of exciting. And then if you're defending champs, you could have a sort of a flame out. I mean, look at what like Toronto fans are going through. All right. Yeah. I mean, Toronto fans, you know, hard sports fans, right? And, you know, they had the, you know, the Maple Leafs have a good history. They won, the Blue Jays won back-to-back World Series when I was growing up. And so then you take this Raptors team and they've had some excitement with the Raptors, but it was like, there wasn't a point until maybe after Clay got hurt that Raptors fans were like, oh, this is it.
Right.
We're going to do it. And then, you know, even if Kawhi had stayed, I don't know that they're necessarily like a lock to repeat if Kawhi stays and there's no coronavirus. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about like a point where there's a thrill that, and it's a rising anticipatory thrill, but it hasn't been consummated. And then you've got that moment where you're champions and you've got that whole summer, but then you get back to the season and it's not guaranteed that you're going to do it. So the Bulls, though, we were living in that. We were living in the best part of both things. The I'm about to be a champ and the I just was a champ.
Right.
Simultaneously. Oh, man, it was amazing. Come on.
I'm getting butterflies. I have butterflies from that answer. Like, I would kill for that.
Yeah, and that's like, I don't think that necessarily shines through in my work on every word and every graph, which is fine because I'm doing a job. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to log things and get the answers and show this piece or that piece or that piece. And you know, when I write my book, I think it's all going to come out in that way. And I've written pieces that are more emotional than historic. But I guess I just kind of, because of what my role is and because of like the niche that I've created and like where my interest is as a researcher, I tend to be more focused on the fact game. And I want like pieces to be thrilling as well. But I don't know that there's a way to like summarize, and maybe this is something I should write about before the doc is over, but I don't know that there's a way in any one of these individual historic pieces to summarize that feeling. And maybe the closest I've gotten to it is in the thread where I announced the book, where I was trying to hit upon like this concept again and again and again and again of like this emotional consistency that we had. I mean, the Blackhawks kind of did it, except they didn't repeat.
They spread it out a bit.
They spread it out a bit, right. Yeah, and that's different. That's like, you know, what San Antonio did. It's different than when you go back to back. And the other thing that it's harder to think about now, I think, but when we got the three-peat in 93, that was the first three-peat since Bill Russell's Celtics.
Yeah.
It seems a little more common now because we did it, and then Houston won back-to-back, and then we did it again. And then after San Antonio got theirs, the Lakers did it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Miami felt like a three-peat. You kind of thought they were going to do it again in 2014. So until the point where it was like, oh, they're getting their asses kicked, you were like, yeah, this is a three-peat team. And the same with Golden State. Like, until the point where you were like, uh-oh, KD's out and Klay's out. Now this is – that was a three-peat team. And so it feels, you know, because over the last 28, 30 years, whatever, like – we've seen it a little bit more, or we've been in a place where it was like, yeah, this is about to happen. But that did not happen. I mean, you know, you had the Pistons had gone back to back, but by 91, it was pretty clear they were not going to win again. They had too many injuries, and it just, even though there's this whole myth that they were old, and I just want to be clear, the 91 Pistons were younger than the 98 Bulls. So everybody can stuff that whole we beat an old team thing. Take that and kick rocks, all right? Because that was not true. But what is true is that you could kind of feel that it wasn't going to happen. The 89 Lakers felt like that could be, but then they kind of fell apart there, certainly in the finals. You had the 90 49ers, you know, who went right down to the wire in the NFC title game against the Giants. That one felt like it might happen. Oh, man, who else was before then? Well, the Cowboys, but I guess by that point we had already done it. So I don't think there'd been a three-peat in any sport since the A's in the 70s at that point, because the Blue Jays were interrupted by the strike. The A's went to three straight World Series in the late 80s, but they only won one of those. So I think it was the 70s A's, and before that it would have been the – no, I'm sorry. You know what? One of those – Edmonton won like four in a row, but you get what I'm saying? Like, it right. was super, super rare. You know, not even somebody like Duke was able to three-peat at their height, even though we went to four straight, Final Fours. So it was, when we did that, it was like, oh man, we might not ever lose. Like, I would love to find, and I've looked, man, and I have no idea. I don't even know what magazine was, but I feel like it was Street and Smith, but I wish I'd bought it so bad. I remember seeing it and somehow simultaneously being like, I should buy this, and then being like, nah, whatever, there'll be another one. So it was after we signed Tony, but it was before Michael retired.
Okay.
And it was a NBA preview magazine that accounted for this new team, like mm-hmm. this three-peat team, but with Kukoc. And I remember it had a driving MJ in a white jersey on the cover, and it said either like four-peat question mark or four-peat exclamation point or something. And I just remember not buying it, and then Michael retired, and I was like immediately like, ah, shit, I should have got that. That's going to be a collector's item. Damn it.
Yeah.
But it was like, it felt like that. It felt like you're just never going to lose.
Right. And I think you touched on an interesting point in the MJ quotes, talking about, and this, they kind of hit on it early in the documentary of Jerry Reinsdorf, like the kind of veiled but not really veiled messages they were sending in the media to the front office and ownership of like, let's keep this thing going. We've got a good thing yeah. going here.
Yeah.
And right. it kind of lends itself to the opening, or I guess the second question now of what we wanted to ask, and that is, Reinsdorf's loyalty, do you see it more as a strength or a weakness? Because it's shown.
That's interesting.
I think in both lights early on in this documentary, and now it kind of has dissipated, and we're waiting for it to come back while they play out the 98 season.
Yeah, that's interesting. Is it a strength or a weakness? Well, I wonder what he would say.
Yeah.
I wonder how he would view this, because as much as he gets killed around this concept of disloyalty. He's been an extraordinarily loyal owner. I mean, if you just look with the Bulls, yeah, all the people who he's employed, he's given out a number of big deals, a number of big extensions. He's paid people who had career-threatening injuries. That's a really good question. Well, I mean, okay. So my opinion, despite people I respect having suggested otherwise, my opinion is that even if Jerry's real idea was that he would keep it going as long as Michael wanted, and because Michael decided that he wasn't going to do it without Phil, and because Phil decided that he was going to bounce, that that was kind of what happened. And that's an argument that Sam Smith has made, and he and I talked about that recently. And so he just notes that, like, well, Michael kind of knew that that team wasn't going to be able to do it again. And I hear him. And but my feeling is that there had to be a way for Jerry to intercede on behalf of Michael and Phil and against Krause, in a way that would let the dynasty not just run to a natural conclusion, but conclude in a way that made it feel to everyone watching, not just fans and reporters, but I think more significantly people around the league, to make it feel as if we were really doing as an organization everything that we could to ensure the happiness of these generational, and that might even be selling it short, these all-time all-timers. Mm-hmm. And we didn't. I've got a piece that I'm working on, and I had asked Sam that, and he made a really good point. He was like, just think of Jerry Krause as the CEO of the most successful business in his field. Mm-hmm. He was like, you don't get fired in that scenario.
Right.
He was like, you keep your job, period. He was like, I don't think Jerry needed to be loyal to Krause or Michael. He could be loyal to both of them. And it was kind of like, when you're the owner, you know, we tend to look at things from the perspective, from that emotional perspective, and Jerry Reinsdorf is going to look at it from a little bit, I feel like a little more detached perspective, where he's like, y'all all work for me, figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to watch how that all played out, with all due respect to anybody who disagrees with me, and to not feel like that it could have been handled better.
Right.
And that I just have to believe that there would have been a way to make Michael happy and to place him at the center of your response. Even if it was like from Jerry's perspective, he's like, well, geez, I paid this guy the two biggest single season contracts of all time. Like, what else does he want? Kind of a right. thing. It's like that, the Mad Men, that's what the money is for mm-hmm. line. And there had to have been a way for us to not go into that season with that level of public internal animosity flying around. I just feel like there had to be. So that's a really interesting way that you put that question. Was his loyalty a plus or a minus, or a strength or a weakness? You know, I guess you can't say. I mean, listen, all right, look at it the other way. So Jerry Krause gets his shot, okay? Mm. Hires the wrong coach.
Yep.
But he has the first pick in a draft that did not have an obvious number one pick. People were saying could be Steve Francis, could be Lamar Odom, and it could be Elton Brand. And we went with Elton. And then I loved that draft. You had Rip Hamilton, Sean Marion, Jason Terry, and then Ron Artest. So he gets Brand and Artest, and then signs Brad Miller. And that's an all-star front court within like 3 years. All three of those guys were all-stars after they left Chicago. Jamal Crawford became a three-time six-man of the year. And the story, as Krause tells it via Sam, is that when we went into that 2000 free agency, you know, Jerry had been enamored with Tracy McGrady since he came out of high school. If we had pulled off, or if we had executed that Scotty deal in 97 to the Celtics, the guy with, you know, we were going to get those two picks from Boston. I think they ended up being 3 and 6. And the guy we were going to we were going to really target was T-Mac. So Jerry, So Jerry, all right. So stay with me. So Jerry wanted to go after Tracy. And the word is that Sam Smith wrote this. He interviewed Krause, and Krause said that Tim Floyd was like, no, we have to like go, we have to like follow the hierarchy of free agents. We have to pursue Duncan and Grant Hill first. And the story is that Jerry deferred to Floyd, and that by the time they got to McGrady, and this part we know is true, by the time they got to McGrady, McGrady felt like he was like the third option because he was.
Yeah.
And McGrady, this is wild, McGrady actually met with the Bulls after he had already agreed to go to Orlando. So let's say Tim Floyd either isn't the head coach, or he doesn't say what he wants to say, or Jerry Krause is like, no, I'm, this is my one shot. You look back at it and you're like, was maybe Jerry Krause is throwing Tim Floyd under the bus with that comment. Like, why not just, this is your shot, go after your guy.
Right.
Whatever happened. Let's say we go get Tracy McGrady. Okay.
Yep.
Forget the coach. Whoever's the coach is the coach. It could be Tim Floyd. It could be me. It could be one of the two of you. Who cares? Okay. Cause here's your lineup hypothetically in 2001. Here are your hypothetical 2001 Bulls. Jamal Crawford as a rookie, or, you know, we had Hoiberg, Matt Maloney, whatever. All right. So we're working on the PG spot. Our test, McGrady, Elton Brand, Brad Miller.
Pretty darn good.
Okay.
Not bad.
Now look at what happened in the East at the outset of the post-Jordan years. You had the Knicks, who got in as an 8 seed in 99. You had a good Indiana team in 2000. Not like an overwhelming team, but a very, very good team that finally broke through. Remember, the Reggie had been in the East Finals 94, 95, 98, 99. So four times. And then you had the Sixers behind an MVP year from Iverson, and you had Mutombo. But you know, that wasn't like a stifling team. And then you had that Nets team. Now, come on, man. Jamal, T-Mac, Artest, Elton Brand, and Brad Miller. We're
Sounds
fighting
like a
for
run
the East.
Right there.
Exactly. Now, and if that happens, then everything with this dynasty looks way different. And if that is the case, then we're not even asking this question. We're saying, hell yeah, Jerry Reinsdorf made the right call. He was loyal to the guy who's got a shelf life. A player, he's only going to last till he's maybe 40, maybe, and that's when Michael played till. But, you know, a good general manager, he can give you 2, 3, 4 generations of talent. Mm-hmm. Look at what Pat Riley does in Miami. Look how, you know, he's been running the show since 96. So in that respect, you look at it and you go, all right, flip a coin. Maybe there's a world where Jerry goes after T-Mac, number one, and maybe we're in the finals in 01 or 02. And then if you have that, this concept of the organization is very different. You know, when the big free agency haul in 2010 was happening, Dwayne Wade in, I think, May of 2010 was like, you know, I look at that organization, I say, where's Michael? Where's Scotty? Look how they treated those guys. Like, loyalty is very important to me. Mm-hmm. Kevin Garnett recently gave an interview over All-Star Weekend where he was like, oh, I was never going to go to the Bulls because look at loyalty. Now, these are two Chicago guys. All right, fine. KG's from South Carolina, but, you know, like, he had this formative experience in Chicago, so much so that when he gave his Anything Is Possible speech after winning his title, he shouted us out. And then And D-Wade is the lifer here. So to have those two guys say like, oh, I would never seriously consider joining the Bulls. Well, maybe if we sign McGrady, that's different. And to me, what's hanging over this documentary is the story of the last 20 years, more so than even the story of those final 12 months. I did an interview the other day with my guy, Ernest Wilkins, for his newsletter Office Hours, and he said, how do you think this documentary ends? And we were kind of debating it. He's just like, I don't know, but like you could go in different directions. Obviously, you're going to have the conclusion of the 98 celebration, but after that, I don't know. I mean, you could have it end with like the collapse. And in a way, it's kind of appropriate to do that because that's why it was the last dance. And that's why, whatever it is now, 22 years later, that concept of finality and almost that like fatalistic vibe of that whole season, that's why that sticks, because we didn't do anything afterward. I always look at the Lakers, like the Lakers as an organization, they take like one era of greatness and they use it to bridge to the next era of greatness.
Yeah.
And the Jerrys talked about how they looked at the 80s Celtics And they were like, you know, they let all those guys stay until they were done. They let Larry stay until his back gave out. They let Robert Parrish stay. Mikhail stayed. He goes, and then all of a sudden, with those three, and then they had that terrible, obviously tragic, those, you know, they, Len Bias died and Reggie Lewis died. But
yeah,
the core of their run got old, and then all of a sudden they had that bad run. So when the Bulls are trying to figure out what they're going to do, when Jerry and Jerry are trying to figure out what they're going to do, they're looking over at the Celtics and they're being like, oh my God, this once proud franchise is like, they're in so much pain and they don't know what the hell's going on. But to me, I'm just like, man, why didn't they look at the Lakers? Like, why did they take the fear approach and say, uh-oh, we don't want to be the 80s, 90s Celtics? Why didn't they say, oh, we have an opportunity to do what the Lakers do, where they went from Mikan to Elgin and Jerry, and then they added Wilt. And then after that team fell off, there was one bad year, and then they went and signed, traded for Kareem. Mm-hmm. They got lucky with that number one pick. They get Magic. They get lucky with another number one pick. They get James Worthy. And then Magic has to retire. They kind of fall off a little bit. And then Jerry West is like, to hell with that. And they go and throw all the money at Shaq.
Yep.
And make the deal for Kobe. And then in a way, they kind of re-upped again, because when they had to do one or the other, they trade Shaq. They kind of double down. They're like, we're going to roll with Kobe. And then they rebuild with Kobe. And then Kobe is the guy who is, you know, the torch carrier. And he helps, like, get LeBron. And Magic Johnson is there as general manager, and he helps get LeBron. It's like the Lakers are always like, we're going to go from this to this to this to this to this.
Yeah.
To me, that's really frustrating that Jerry and Jerry didn't look at the Lakers instead of the Celtics.
Did mention how does this doc end, and like thinking about the different ways this can go. And a lot of points in these first few episodes, it's like the portrayal of certain people, it's kind of reminding me that this is a MJ doc. This is not really a 98 Bulls team doc.
Yeah, like, don't ever forget that.
Where do you think MJ wants this, like, how do you think he wants this to finish up? Because I think it's much differently. It's going to be told much differently than someone without a documentary without MJ's input is ending.
No, but that's such a good question. How does Michael want this to end? So he gave an interview, I think it was when he turned 50, with Ahmad, and he was kind of saying, I believe that when you're on the mountaintop, you play until they beat you. Mm-hmm. And okay, that's my answer. Whether he says it directly or whether the documentary infers it in some sequence of interviews or footage or something, that's what it will be. It will be the lasting, the lasting vibe will be, number one, holy shit, this was amazing. Number two, holy shit, Michael's amazing. Mm-hmm. Number three, I wanted to stay, we got screwed. I mean, Michael is settling scores for sure. And he's laying out like the blueprint for how he's going to be received for the next, the rest of his life, basically.
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful clip after the sixth title where Michael and Scotty are sitting in the locker room with champagne, and Scotty's kind of talking to people, but Mike is just crooning. And you may have seen it. And they showed it in this Ahmad interview. It's on YouTube. It's one of my absolute favorites. And Mike's going, six. Six, six of them, six of them. And then he kind of laughs and he goes, say whatever you want. They can't win until we quit. And I guarantee you, they can't win until we quit will be in the last like 2-3 minutes, yep, 5 minutes of the documentary, because it will really hammer home this idea that, like, well, Michael would have kept going and he was artificially stopped. You know, I just think that, like, look, and MJ even said this in 99 at the Birdo Center, or 2000, we got six in 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Lakers got five, the Celtics, that's the ultimate, the 11 and 13, that'll never be topped, but we got six. And there were just a lot of internal forces, these huge, hugely talented people and these huge personalities.
Mm-hmm.
All of which are in the Hall of Fame. Both Jerry's, Phil, Michael, Scotty, Dennis, all in the Hall of Fame. And deservingly so. And it was just, you know, the thing was just kind of torn apart by internal forces. I always say it's like the Beatles. Like, stop looking at Yoko. Yeah. Bunch of really talented people blew up, did their thing, and got tired of each other. And that's just how it goes sometimes.
That's actually an awesome analogy because I hadn't even looked at it that way just because of the fact that Yoko gets thrown under the bus so much. So who is Yoko, I guess?
I said it was like Jerry Krause. I wrote that after he died. I wrote that. And obviously he had more to do with the Bulls than Yoko had with the Beatles, but it's sort of the same idea of like the scapegoat in the face of these others. Yeah.
So we've kind of beat around the bush a little bit, or I guess we've talked about it in different ways, but Jerry Krause is obviously a huge figure in this. And I guess early on, first couple episodes were not great for him. Do you think that the portrayal has been fair of Jerry Krause so far?
No.
Easy.
Here's why.
Yeah.
By all accounts, he was just a real son of a bitch. Mm-hmm. He was just a real pain in the ass. He rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. He probably did these things because it was the way that he felt he had to in order to maintain some semblance of leverage and power and to do the job the way that he thought it was supposed to be done. Mm-hmm. The way that he thought he always said he was like a scout at heart, and the way that you operate as a scout, as far as Jerry was concerned, was you don't let anybody know what it is you're doing. You go out on your own, you do the work, you draw your own conclusions, you keep close counsel, and to hell with anybody else. And the reason I say that he is not being treated fairly is that I have not yet heard anyone, I can't think of anybody other than his wife, who's been able to compliment him without somehow talking about the way that he is kind of a pain in the ass. Mm-hmm. And the same with Jordan. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to compliment Michael, at least within the respect of his career as a basketball player.
Yeah.
Not talking about the things that he's done with like the Make-A-Wish Foundation or other charitable things or none of that stuff. Just talking about him on the court, you can't compliment Michael without critiquing him, except that we kind of all say, like, this is great. How many times have we read stories in the last 3 weeks, much less the last 30 years, that's like, Michael is such a savage, and he, like, ripped this guy's throat, voice box, out of his throat during halftime with his bare hands. And the guy to this day talks with a voice box and will be the first to tell you, Michael taught me some of the greatest life lessons. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
Yeah.
But because we like him.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, come on. We're all MJ fans. But it's like legitimate. I'm not saying like it shouldn't be. There are some people who try to like kill him on that, but I don't. I get it. Like, and we just saw the preview that ESPN posted for the next episode of Wennington, Purdue, Bushler, and Scotty all being like, yeah, he kicked our ass and we were afraid of him and that's what we needed and that's why we're champions. And Michael has said the same thing. There was a great profile that I think it was Jackie McMullen did on Kobe, and I think she interviewed Michael and he was talking about some of the similarities between he and Kobe and lessons that maybe he passed along or that Kobe absorbed. And he said, you know, something like, and I'm misquoting it, but it was something like, yeah, it was a pain in the ass, but why don't you ask like Judd Bushler and Bill Wennington and Steve Kerr and Luke Longley if they like their championship rings, kind of thing.
Right.
So, but that doesn't really have the same translation with Jerry Krause because there's no hero projection involved. You're not watching Jerry saying like, oh, I want to be that. It's like one of the reasons that Michael sold shoes way better than all these other guys is because like, there's a direct connection in the imagination between your footwear and your ability to jump.
Mm-hmm.
There was always that kind of tie between a marketing image and the production on the court and the fantasy of the buyer, of the consumer, of the watcher, which is us. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't exist with Jerry. So that kind of element wasn't there to rebrand his prickliness in some kind of heroic frame. But even the people who like him seem to kind of say like, yeah, he was like a real pain,
right?
And so I think that if the documentary, which like you said, and which anybody who was astute about this realized, Michael's a producer on this and had final cuts. So like, right, of course it's going to be what it is. But you know, we had the MJ section. We had the Scotty section. I mean, like the going back in time, this is what their life was like. Mm-hmm. We had the Dennis section and we had the Phil section. And man, I wish we would have had the Jerry Krause section. Right. Jerry would have still come off in the exact same way in the present tense. There's no sugarcoating a quote like 82-0, you're fucking gone. Mm-hmm. Even if we get into like what led to them having a beef in the first place and try to dive into that.
Yeah.
It still doesn't matter. It does. There's almost, you know, it's so hard to look at a statement like that or to look at something like, you know, when Phil was still unsigned after 97, this is one of those like great underappreciated elements of that Scotty trade. Do you know that Jerry Krause banned Phil Jackson from the Birdo Center?
I don't know. I don't know if I knew it off the top of my head.
So Michael was a free agent after 97. Phil, I don't know if you call a coach a free agent, but he was unsigned.
Right.
Dennis was unsigned. Scotty's got one more year, and that's why they're looking. That's why they were looking at trading Scotty, the idea being like, now's the chance to capitalize. Mm-hmm. So the trade was going to be, I've seen it written in different permutations. I don't know if it was ever locked in, but the trade was going to be some combination of Scotty and I always saw it with Luke Longley for these two Celtics picks. Mm-hmm. So the Bulls obviously are going to be picking in whatever, the low 20s, however many teams are in the NBA at that point, right? We're picking last.
Right.
28, 29, 30. However, if you make the Celtics deal, then you're also drafting 3 and 6.
Yeah.
So you're working out two very different sets of prospects. You're working out guys who you're going to pick at 30, and you're working out guys who you might pick at 3. Mm-hmm. Jerry Krause decided that Phil Jackson could be in the Birdo Center when we're working out the guys at 30. Mm. But if we make this Pippen trade, we're going to just go in a different direction. And I bet Phil's not even going to want to come back in this scenario. And therefore, he doesn't need to know about this.
Wow.
It's none of your business what we do at the 3 and the 6, because I project that if we do this trade, you're not even our head coach. So he banned fucking Phil Jackson from the Birdo Center while he worked out T-Mac and whoever else they worked out, Ron Mercer or whoever, okay? Mm-hmm. There's no way to sugarcoat an act like that.
Right.
But if we had had the Jerry Krause section in one of those first two episodes, it increases the tension of the – I mean, it makes it such a better story.
Yep.
Because now you're like, oh, I kind of like this guy, but also I hate him. As opposed to now where every time he's on screen, you're like, ah, this fucking son of a bitch. If we got it
so early
mm-hmm. and so completely, but it's like, that's not what makes stories interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, I saw Ken Burns was getting all pissy and being like, this isn't how the path of journalism. I'm like, Ken Burns, bro, this is not journalism. So like, don't even sweat it, man. Like journalism's got a lot of problems, but The Last Dance is not one of them.
No.
But like, Jerry's a Chicago guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was bullied growing up. And as an adult, clearly, but also became a bully as a result of that. He was in the Bulls front office. He was running the show in the 70s, which a lot of people don't know. He got fired, as the story goes, because he tried to low-key offer the head coaching job to Ray Meyer and then tried to backpedal it and you know, you don't piss off Ray Meyer in this town in the 70s.
Right.
And he got fired. He's a baseball scout working with the White Sox. He's got like a great, great story. And I encourage everybody to read. So in 1990, Ben Jarofsky at the Chicago Reader did a profile on Jerry Krause called Nobody Cheers for Jerry Krause. It's fabulous. And it's like, this is before we've won anything. So... Yep. Hypothetically, the Bulls at that point, maybe they were never going to win anything. You know, we lose to Detroit. Maybe we blow it in 91, and maybe who knows what happens. But it's like Jerry was already Jerry. He was like that guy. But you kind of also better understand where he's coming from. There's a great there's a great anecdote or a great little scene where he was recruiting. I'm just gonna read this to you. So let's see. He says, I remember the time I met Red Holtzman, who was the former coach of the Knicks, mm-hmm. and who should be mentioned in this documentary, and I'll tell you why in a second. But he goes, I remember the first time I met Red Holtzman, and I was getting off of a flight at the St. Louis airport on a Saturday morning, and there's Red sitting in the terminal. We were the only two guys there. It must have been 7 o'clock in the morning. He looks at me and says, you're Krause, aren't you? I said, yeah. He said, I understand you work real hard. I said, thank you. He said, where you been? I didn't want to tip him to who I was scouting, so I said, up the road. Well, old Red, he looks at me and he says, now listen, Krause, I know for certain you were in Oklahoma City last night because there were only two games worth seeing and I was at the one in Wichita. Secondly, I know you're going to scout the Van Arsdale boys because this plane's going to Indianapolis and I know they're the only ones worth seeing up there. Jerry says, by this time I was standing like a big dummy with my mouth open, and he finishes up by saying, so don't ever try to lie to old Red again. Okay? Now look at that anecdote. Think about the image of this young Jerry Krause already kind of developing his game and getting put in his place by a guy who he totally admires and respects, but like mm-hmm. put in his place in a way that you kind of like he's kind of like, oh, I feel kind of honored the way that I was just put in my place.
Right.
Red Holtzman coached the 70s Knicks. You can draw a direct line from the 70s Knicks to the 90s Bulls to the 2010 Warriors. Mm-hmm. The Knicks were a team that were all about ball movement. All five people on the floor are involved. We're going to have equal scoring threats, even though obviously Willis Reed is the best scorer. Clyde Frazier, obviously a great scorer, but you're never going to quite know where the damage is going to come from. Mm-hmm. And Jerry Reinsdorf grew up in New York and loved that team and wanted that kind of a team for the Bulls. And Jerry Krause admired Red Holtzman and wanted that kind of a team for the Bulls. Who was on the 70s Knicks? Phil Jackson. I wish that they would kind of put those pieces together and show you, like, this is why these guys all came together. Mm-hmm. Like, we're only looking at why they all fell apart, but it creates a better story, and it is a better story if you tell the whole story. And that would make you really understand Jerry Krause, and that would give you a more complete picture and a better experience. And yet you would still get to have people telling these stories of being pissed at Jerry. You're not gonna lose that edge. If Michael wants to slam Jerry up and down, he's free to do so. And it's warranted because of things like banning the damn head coach out of the Borough Center. So it's just like you could treat him better and still treat him like shit.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
And He kind of comes off as like really early in the documentary as like this Mr. Swaghammer from Space Jam character is how he's portrayed early. And I think one of the disservices they really do early on in, I want to say it's the third, fourth episode, that they kind of pass over that Doug Collins is not the coach, decides to hire Phil when they are obviously a team on the rise, and right. Michael is obviously in love with his coach. Right. And I mentioned that to say, I don't even think Phil gets his full due in this documentary either. And I think one of the most interesting parts about, I guess, Phil coaching this team in the 90s alongside Michael's like ultra competitiveness is just the complete contrast between seeing clips of Phil leading the team in yoga and Michael talking about Phil's Zen and meditation, being in the moment. And mm-hmm. it seems like something that is so opposite from what Michael Jordan would want to adopt, but it's a testament to Phil's skill as a coach and managing personalities that 100%. He was able to take this ultra competitive, rip your throat out guy mm-hmm. and bring him in to be like a, lack of a better word, disciple for Phil Jackson.
Yeah, no, that's really well said, and that is what Phil was able to do, And I agree with you that in that respect, they are selling him a little bit short. I think they're selling Scotty a little bit short. I would encourage anybody who wants to see maybe the total package of what Scotty was about, go watch the Christmas Day game, 1994. So the 94-95 season. Scotty has, spoilers, sorry. Scotty had his career, season high. I don't think it was a career high, but it was a season high at that point. I think he had like 36 points, played defense off, just out of control defense. And the game went to overtime. And he ended that game by blocking, I think it was Starks or Hubert Davis, but he blocks two straight shots to win the game. The reason we got to OT was that the Knicks were down, I think, by three, and they had this long length of the court pass. And Steve Kerr, the ball was coming toward him, and instead of catching it, he did the thing where you try to bat it down. We see this go wrong in the NFL a lot. Not a lot, but enough. It's like, that's the worry. Mm-hmm. You're going to try to bat the ball down. It's going to go to somebody else on the other team. So that's what happened. Kerr knocks the ball, and it goes right to a guy on the Knicks who's standing at the three-point line. And as soon as it happens, you can see Kerr going through this horror show in slow motion. And as soon as he does it, he sees, oh my goodness. And whoever it was catches it, knocks down the three to send it to overtime, and Kerr is crushed. So Scotty, after he blocks these two shots to end the game, is obviously celebrating, and he's celebrating with teammates, and everyone's high-fiving him, and you can see Kerr come up and sort of say something, and Scotty's whole demeanor kind of changes, and he gives Steve a big hug. And Scotty was the guy who made everybody feel good and everybody feel welcome, but he was also a superstar. He was one of the top five players of the league at his peak. He was arguably the MVP of the league at his peak, and was headed, you know, by 92, you were like, oh, this guy's going to be in the Hall of Fame. And so he kind of had this bridge role between this maniacal leadership of Michael and kind of like everybody else, and was key to making that second team feel so unified all the way up and down the roster. And he was the key to kind of connecting Michael and Phil. There was like this leadership triumphant of Michael, Phil, and Scotty. Mm-hmm. And it was like Michael was like this engine, maybe, and Phil was the direction, and Scotty was the heart. I don't know if my metaphor is working, but it was like he was a key piece, right, to making all these guys feel good and to making everybody feel, you know, it's like you don't read The Great Gatsby and relate to Gatsby, you know? It's impossible.
It's like they're almost their own triangle outside of, like,
yeah.
To put it cheesily, they're like their own triangle offense outside of, like, in terms of personality and management style.
Yep. And Michael has a great interview, or had a great interview with Rick Tellender down the stretch in 98. And he said, people say if I hadn't played baseball for a year and a half, we would be going for our eighth championship in a row, but I don't think so. After our three-peat, the atmosphere on the team wasn't the same. On this team, we love each other. No jealousies, no animosities, no nothing. Is there another team like that? On our team, everybody gets along with everybody. Everybody can go out with everybody. We're not afraid to criticize each other. And then he says later, I don't think this is our best Bulls team. The first one was more balanced, younger, more agile. And he says, and the desire was stronger. But back then, we had guys who had never won anything. He's talking about human nature, but I love that bit about everybody loves each other, no jealousies, no animosities. Mm-hmm. And Scotty was a huge piece of creating that atmosphere. And, you know, that first three-peat they'd all gone through it together. So, you know, so let's see, Dennis Hobson was in his first year with the team in 91, Cliff Livingston, and Scott Williams was a rookie. And everybody else had been through that game seven the year before. And most of those guys, a number of them, had been through the loss in 89. And a number of them had been through the losses in 88. Whereas, like, the second three-peat was microwaved. And they didn't have that same kind of rise and crushing loss. I guess the Orlando loss was kind of like that. But even that was, like, fast. It was bad, and then it was over. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways in which that team was able to bond in lieu of that deep journey that that first three-peat team went on is the fact that you had Michael and Scotty working in what Phil called a dual leadership role. And you had Scotty being like the mortal of the immortals, almost. Yeah. Like the guy who could like explain the true immortal to you and like get you to be, you know, understood by him. I would encourage everybody at least to watch the highlights of that game. It's Christmas Day, 1994, Bulls-Knicks, the 94-95 season. And look at Scotty's offense, look at Scotty's defense, and look at Scotty's leadership. It's more than leadership, though. It's welcoming. It's being a welcoming person to say, like, you're okay with me, and we're going to do it together. And that was a really important feeling in that second group. I don't think we're going to see anything in this documentary that approaches things like Michael throwing Horace Grant under the bus for the Jordan rules, or Craig Hodges is disappointed with MJ and the things that, you know, BJ and Cartwright have said have been like complimentary, but kind of not totally. I just, the vibe on those two teams, I keep saying the word vibe, it's late, I'm sorry, but the vibe on those two teams was different. Even though they both won three titles, they both were teams that turned defense into offense, they both ran the triangle, they had very similar coaching staffs, etc. But yeah. But that second group did have a togetherness and a sense of unified purpose, and a lot of that came from Scotty. And so Pete, when you say that you think that we're selling the doc almost sells Phil short, I agree with you. I think it almost sells Scotty short as well. So it's like, you know, it is the documentary. It's what it is. It's the Michael story. Mm-hmm. You know, what is the relationship between the dream team and the last dance? There is none, right? Unless you're telling the MJ doc, in which case, like, oh, okay, sure. You gotta hit the high notes. Mm-hmm. You gotta play all the, I feel like this is almost like a better produced longer NBA entertainment video. I mean, like, this, it's yeah. got like kind of the same bits of mythology to them,
right?
You know, Isaiah Thomas had a quote in November of 91 where he was like, was it selfish that we did the walk off? Yeah. Was it bad sportsmanship? Yeah. But we were pissed, and it would be silly of me to say otherwise. I would have loved for them to like take that quote right to Isaiah and make him address it. Right. And at the same time, I would have loved for them to go to Michael and Phil and say, you know, you guys were all up in the league office talking about, hey, they're beating us up and everything. And then they added the flagrant too. Like, what kind of impact do you think that had on your ability to get past Detroit? And just like, I don't think that's the reason we beat Detroit, but I would have loved to have seen that as a question brought to them and really depended more or relied more, or I guess utilized past quotes in a better way, so that you could say like, hey, you said this, what did you mean by that? Right. Or you said this, I'm not going to let you escape and say that you didn't say it or that it was something else. But that's what it is. It's a MJ produced MJ doc. And I'm glad we've got it.
Right.
We're having fun.
We need it. And it's certainly interesting and something to talk about. We will definitely link to that. Nobody Cheers for Jerry Krause article in the show notes.
It's phenomenal. Yeah.
And then try and find something on that 94 Christmas game as well. But final question from us. Obviously, we've talked at length that this is a Michael Jordan documentary.
Yeah.
Who do you think is going to come out looking the best outside of MJ? Because clearly Jerry Krause is going to come out looking the worst.
Yeah.
I guess it's just a degree to what degree he's going to look bad. But who comes out as second best?
Rodman.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with that.
Right?
It's so far, Rodman, yeah.
Right? Yeah. It's got to be Rodman because his scenes are the most fun.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they've, I mean, Pete, it's like you said, they haven't really explained what Scotty did. I feel like they've explained what Dennis did, like what his role was and why he was great. And his scenes are super fun, of course.
And they're the sparkling scenes of him too, no less.
Oh yeah, right. And did we get kicking the cameraman? Did we get headbutting the ref? Did we see those?
In passing. They were like in a montage, really.
Right. Yeah, Dennis, Steve Kerr, they put him on the poster because he's, you know, Steve Kerr now.
Right.
Who else? Well, you know, NBC Sports Chicago aired Game 7 of the Bulls Pacers series tonight, and so anybody
I was watching that,
I was watching a little bit too. So anybody who hadn't seen that or hadn't remembered it, you know, they watch that third quarter and they see Tony go off. So maybe we're gonna get. I assume that we're gonna get like a nice fat section on Game 7. It was the only Game 7 of the second three-peat. It was only one of two that they had in a championship year. It was only one of four that they had with Michael. One of four that they had with Phil. One of three they had with Michael. So we'll see that, and then I think people will be like, "Oh, Tony Kukoc, dope." So like, I think his moment is still to come. That's a great question. Yeah, who's gonna look the best? I'll say Dennis. Yeah,
perfect.
Hopefully they get into Scottie's dunk against the Bullets that wrapped that series, the drive and where he fell on his tailbone. That'd be cool. I mean, I guess that's coming. So what do we have left? So like, this episode is gonna be his retirement and. Yes. And where are we in the 98 storyline?
They were, I can't remember if I'm mixing
it up. Did they get into the playoffs yet?
I think it first round against the Nets, right?
Did they show that though?
I think they ended it with saying that they're about to play the Nets.
They're about to.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I watched so many old games, and I've been kind of like in and out of the room for this documentary where I haven't been able to watch it exactly when everybody else does. So I record it and then I've been filling it in. I get lost in like what's been shown because I know like the whole story,
right?
So yeah, I mean, hopefully they'll get into that bullets dunk. Nah, we'll see. Dennis is my answer to that question.
Dennis, thank you so much, Jack. We really appreciated the conversation, and again, check him out on Twitter at ReadJack, and the book Six Rings coming out in 2021.
Yeah, and the newsletter.
Yes,
definitely.
It's absolutely worth it.
Pete and Brian, thank you guys for having me. This was really good. I'm glad we got to do this. I appreciate you giving me your time.